On the Digital Divide, host Rabia Yemin welcomes cyberpunk author and former Sado Nation band member John Shirley into the studio. And tomorrow is the first day of our fall membership drive. Please help us start it off with a bang. Well, good night, Grace Ann.
Good night, Doug.
Good night, Matthew.
Good night.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Tomorrow at noon at Pioneer Square in downtown Portland, there will be a rally in solidarity with Standing Rock. And as the showdown at Standing Rock happens in North Dakota over the Dakota Access Pipeline, the thousands of native land and water defenders at Sacred Stone Camp and their supporters await a decision tomorrow on a possible court injunction on work around the site of the Missouri River crossing. Paul Rowland spoke with the Yakima Tribal Council Chairman Joe Day Gowdy by phone from the Yakima Reservation in eastern Washington earlier this afternoon.
I believe we had 11 out of our 14 council individuals, as well as our general counsel chairman who accompanied us on the travels over there. Ultimately, you know, the Yakima Nation, we're very aware of what's going on across Indian country with the various specific issues that are out there, and we keep a keen eye on those issues, you know, obviously what goes on in Indian country has a potential to either positively or negatively affect the Yakima Nation and our various issues and challenges and battles that are going on. And so as we were keeping an eye on the situation over in Standing Rock, you know, and as things begin to escalate, as we observed the interaction that was coming from the Corps of Engineers and the different events that had happened, filing of the nation in district court in D.C. against the Corps of Engineers for a lack of consultation, you know, the filing of the corporation against Standing Rock members on the issuance for a temporary restraining order, those kind of things, we believe it escalated to a point that indeed we gathered informal tribal council session and began to identify, you know, that the Yakima Nation was going to offer some type of assistance, what would be the most effective and beneficial way that we could do so. And from there, we kind of formulated a plan with which to travel, and a number of our leaders felt it was important enough to physically be there to offer that support, and we were able to get some other things as far as assistance and support that we were able to deliver and bring to the Standing Rock Nation and the rest of the nations who are gathered there.
Yeah, you took a semi-truck, right, of donations?
Yeah, we were able to accumulate a semi-full of food and water from the nation, you know, our enterprises, some of our members who made donations, and collectively we had the semi-truck travel with us. We kind of caravaned over and were able to deliver that to camp, which they received very well and were very appreciative, and we definitely were happy to provide such.
So you spoke of the Corps of Engineers. Obviously, your tribe and the tribes of the Northwest are well familiar with the Army Corps of Engineers, and you know, you said you're looking at how what's happening in Standing Rock could affect the Yakima Nation. Your nation has been involved in some fundamental legal cases that have set a lot of precedents on treaty issues around the country as well, right?
Yeah, obviously anyone who is somewhat aware of the Yakima Nation, we have a long-standing history of standing up for our rights, and that goes back to the initial and formal interaction between the United States and the Yakima Nation back to 1855, in the Treaty of 1855 between the United States and the Yakima, which was a peace treaty, and that obviously there's various articles associated, and there's reserved rights that are associated within those articles that our ancestors, our former chiefs, and great leaders of the past memorialized in the Treaty of 1855 on behalf of the Yakima. Throughout time, we've had various issues that have come in all fronts, but issues, you know, directly related to what's going on in Standing Rock. I think anyone that's somewhat paying attention here in the Pacific Northwest knows that there's a proposal for a fossil fuel superhighway and various coal terminals as well as oil refineries and plants have been proposed, and the Yakima Nation has taken upon itself to be one of the leaders around the Northwest here in making our voice and our position very well known to the entities that are proposing such, that we are against that. We don't believe it's in the best interest of our current, not only Yakima Nation membership, all the other associated Native nations that are represented here in the Northwest, but as well as all Washington State citizens, Oregon residents, and everybody that benefits and appreciates the ability to have our natural resources to the best of our ability in current day preserved in a manner that will be beneficial not only to us today, but to our future generations to come. We have a substantial background in dispute resolution that's found ourselves into the judicial system of the United States, as well as many legislative efforts throughout time, and obviously approaching the executive branch and the various sitting presidents throughout time as well. Because of the uniqueness of the articles, and not only the articles of our treaty, but the minutes that memorialize the negotiations of our treaty. And so we take an absolute strong stance on trying to maintain to the best of our ability the promises that were associated and memorialized about 160 years ago.
So what does this mean? Has anybody ever seen anything like this? I know there's National Congress of American Indians, obviously, where people get together and have discussions amongst all the, you know, the nations of the United States. But this is a very different situation. Like, are there general council meetings going on there?
I think it's a pretty unprecedented event. You know, as far as the strategical council meetings associated with the very essential facts at hand, I think it's a challenge specific to the issue because of all the various moving parts that are going on and the entire situation related to the Sacred Stone Camp there and what's going on at Standing Rock. But, you know, I mean, not only historically, but currently there's for us as Native nations, this is nothing new. What is different about this is there's actually being some awareness and some people that are paying attention. And the uniqueness of what Standing Rock has done is made a very strong stance of absolutely demanding that the law be adhered to, not only by the corporations who are proposing the pipeline, the federal agencies such as Corps of Engineers who are granting approval of such, but to the United States in general, pursuant to their treaty. You know, they have reserved rights and reserved protections that their historical leaders have had memorialized for their people today and for their future generations. And so there's various challenges, I think, that are a part of that. And what is being highlighted is that the constant fight that Native nations are enduring as far as trying to stand up for the various rights that we believe are important to the sustained existence of us as peoples and of us as nations are finding themselves into various forms of dispute resolution. And what we find very hard to deal with is that in the forms that are dictated to the various Native nations in the dispute resolution oftentimes is the judicial system of the federal court, and that the policies and the entities and agencies at hand are utilize the various laws, legislation, the various case law that's set historical precedents on the various issues. You know, I can't speak specifically to Standing Rock. I think that their treaty is a little bit different than Yakima Nation. But for Yakima Nation and Standing Rock, I can say this, is that pursuant to the U.S. Constitution, Article 6 and Section 2 states that treaties are indeed the highest law of the land, and all states are thereby bound to. How are you to put into the face of the articles of our treaty the reserved rights that are associated with that treaty, which is backed up by Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, and then come in and tell us that various legislative efforts that have passed and various case law that has, in their eyes, set precedents, override and overrule the articles and the reserved rights of our treaty? And the argument from the United States oftentimes will be that, this is how things are, you know, but they have no clear answer specific to those things. And one of the things that the Yakima Nation also offered to Standing Rock Nation was, you know, we had Yakima Nation We deal with a number of attorneys and contracted law firms for all of our dispute resolution that's out there. But one of the firms that's very well versed in federal Indian law, and they've had various representations for the Yakama Nation, and that's Philando and Broadman. And we reached out to them. They were very interested in the Standing Rock situation themselves and help us with issues that surround the proposed fossil fuel superhighway here in the Pacific Northwest. So upon reaching out to, you know, one of the partners of the firm, Mr. Gabe Melanda, I told him, I said, look, we'd like you to come with us, but unfortunately, we can't pay you to do so. Would you consider doing that pro bono? And so immediately he said, of course. But him and one of his other associates, Mr. Joe Sexton, traveled with us, but they traveled on their own dime. And so we were able to introduce them to the Standing Rock leadership and offer them any type of legal assistance that they would want, and they were going to do so at pro bono for free for Standing Rock. And so they were able to engage before we had left. I did some analysis specific to the variations that are associated in the Standing Rock Fort Laramie Treaty, and obviously there's some differences different than the Yakama Nation 1855 Treaty. There is a different, I guess you can say, foundation involved in some of the historical victories that Yakama Nation has been able to have throughout time, and that's why we felt it all the more imperative that we were able to offer some type of assistance in whatever way that we could. But first and foremost, you know, the Yakama Nation and the Standing Rock Sioux Nation, both nations have existed since time immemorial, and we've had interactions since our origin times, and we've come together in ceremony, we've come together in song, and exchanging of our foods and trading and so on and so forth. So, you know, the other things that we were able to offer, you know, as far as material and physical to Standing Rock Nation, the most important that we felt as the Yakama Nation was to engage from a traditional and our ceremonial interaction with them, which we were able to do. But there's also an ability, I guess you can say, to bring forth sound and solid arguments on behalf of the Standing Rock. And I believe the Cheyenne River has joined them in their legal side. But Yakama Nation, you know, as I stated earlier, anyone that has been paying attention to the various proposals regarding coal export and oil refineries and so on and so forth, we definitely don't want any type of negative precedents to be set against the Standing Rock Nation and our other nations involved with their fights to come back and try to be utilized against the Yakama Nation and our strong stance and efforts that we're making to ensure that indeed many of the proposals, if not all of the proposals for the superhighway of fossil fuel that's being proposed here in the Northwest, get shot down. That's the goal. We do not want such things here. They are existing. They are occurring. We've taken substantial steps to join with other nations and entities and individuals against that effort. Just to kind of briefly express on behalf of Standing Rock and their plight, you know, that not only are they standing for the obviously the very common sense arguments that are there, but they're standing upon law, and that anyone who knows and does a little bit of research on some of the pipelines that exist and are there that are associated throughout the North American continent, specifically the United States, you know, just in the last decade, there's been, I think, about 12,000 pipeline incidents, and there's about just under a $7 billion cost associated with those incidents, and that's just in the last 10 years from the
leaks and spills, yeah.
Some of the statistics that I was able to observe, you know, just in 2015 alone, there was 708 pipeline incidents, and there was 12 deaths associated with those incidents, and about $340 million in damages. That goes to the fact that if the pipeline indeed is able to materialize in the pathway that's there, it's not if, but when a leak occurs and the damage that will be incurred, you know, by everyone that's going to be impacted by that cannot be mitigated and it cannot be undone. And the other determining factor that I think it's imperative to share with the listeners out there is that, you know, they're not doing so off their own dime. The various companies associated with building the pipeline, you know, collectively, they have about $10.25 billion in loans and credit facilities from about 38 banks that are supporting the effort. not just the pipeline there, the Dakota Access Pipeline. There's behind the scenes as well consequences that I think that are not coming to light at this point, that if indeed you have that type of money from those financial institutions, I mean, obviously those banking institutions are definitely looking for a return on their investment. And when you look and when I observe the lack of leadership from the federal level, from the potential presidential candidates, and unfortunately from President Obama himself, who seems to have forgotten that he personally went and visited Standing Rock Nation and made various commitments and promises to their children and to their peoples and to their lands, that it seems to have been a deafening silence from individuals who should be voicing very responsible concerns and advocating for responsible decisions. But if you're able to follow some of the money involved with this, I wouldn't want to have it go into the realm of a conspiracy. But if you follow the dollars that are associated with all the moving parts of this, you come to understand why there's so much political silence on what is happening here.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 p.m. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
Hi, I'm Rabia Yeaman, producer and host of The Digital Divide. Tune in to The Digital Divide Friday, September 9th at 11 a.m. We'll have cyberpunk author, musician, and composer John Shirley live in the studio. And for this membership drive special, John is donating 3 original proofs of his cyberpunk science fiction novel, Heatseeker, all 3 signed. John is one of the founders of Portland's early punk scene and a member of punk band Sado Nation. Call in and become a member during this very rare membership drive special. That's The Digital Divide, Friday, September 9th at 11 a.m.
Hi, this is John Shuck, host of a new program, The Beloved Community, Insights for Activism.